Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Well, folks, it is now or never, and we're actually giving you great academic evidence that the stage has been set. The Antichrist is, and I don't like doing the religion and the preaching. I mean, that's what you need to do on Sunday. That's something you need to do on a daily basis. You need to sit down, you know, get on your knees, pray. You need to read the scriptures. These are things, just like eating, these are things that you should be doing. So what we're trying to do is only complement all of that feasting that you have in your daily life with a real-life picture of what government is doing and how this can't be just necessarily misconstrued as this window of opportunity. This is something that they have been working and putting into place so that they can instantly seize the ability to control everything we do. And even though it seems innocuous, and so here's the real, this is one of the things I didn't get a chance to talk about in the show yet, in this interview, nor do I get a chance to talk about this. But when one looks at, you know, how problems are solved and how they implement solutions, what they do is they create this huge problem. The majority of America do not buy the narrative that the 2020 election was a legitimate election. Nobody buys that. There's very few people that buy that. There's been enough evidence that they realize that they can't suppress this. They do know that there's this thing out there that, you know, I'll just call it the House bill I think it's the Voter Act or something like that, where the federal government wants to seize full control of elections. It's not within the Constitution. They can't do it. However, with the selling and the joint effort of the two-party system, or I should say the uniparty system, and how the Republicans are going to present this solution of going to the Real ID Act. This is our savior. This is the one thing that we need to embrace so that we can actually control our elections. It doesn't matter how they sell it. All of the baggage that comes with it comes with it. And in that baggage, they have all the tools necessary to start moving down this path of basically China Part 2, creating a big brother system, because they already have the technology, they already have the ability. They're already using it. They just aren't using it at a full scale where the state governments become their pawns. Folks, we're being set up. And you have to understand that we actually have to start taking back at the state level all of these controls, that the states have to do this without and divorcing the federal government's involvement in all of the things that they do, which means that they're going to have to cut their budget strings. They're going to have to say, we're not taking your money anymore. Because what will happen is if the states tell the federal government, you know what, we're not going to let you do this, and we're not going to let you regulate that and so forth, the first thing that they always do is, well, we're going to take our money back. Well, that's your money, states. In other words, they have to tax your people. Well, technically, they can print it, but that's still, that's making something out of nothing. And that causes all sorts of problems. And this is why we have all of these problems anyway. What we have to do is we have to start uniting and taking back local government. Because the secret literally is forcing your public servants to comply to the Constitution or you get rid of them. And demand that they give you the power to do whatever is necessary. So we're going into a quick break, or actually we've just got this little pause. When this music is over, we'll be starting the part two segment. And then at the end, we'll have another break with a promo, and then I'll wrap it up. Please pay attention. Please listen to this interview. This is a very important interview. We'll be right back. Okay, folks, thank you so much, Mark, for being patient and giving us more of your time. And so what we kind of covered without having to do the full history is we kind of got to a point where this concept of the Real ID Act began to germinate and to start to grow legs, and it created legislation. And one of the things I think is really important is the paradigm of many of the states when they started seeing this. As a matter of fact, this was even more of, because when people look at Obamacare, which was a few years later, we realized that, or most people may not know, that there were 26 states that sued the government that went to the Supreme Court. In other words, the states didn't just roll over. And I believe the exact same thing happened with the Real ID Act, but I want you to kind of talk about how they responded and how, you know, either rejected or what have you. So I don't want to put words in your mouth. Let's talk about this germinating process and the macro view of how it was being perceived and how they were reacting.
Well, what happened is, going back to 2005 when it became law, actually the ACLU, of all organizations, they opposed the Real ID Act based on the fact that they felt the federal government had no right to get involved in the issuance of a state driver's license. So the ACLU got together other advocacy groups to oppose Real ID. The problem with the ACLU and the way they went about it, they didn't understand the Real ID Act fully themselves. The Real ID Act itself is not a long piece of legislation, but the only way it got passed in 2005 was by adding it to two must-pass pieces of legislation. One was a military spending bill, and one was tsunami relief. So Real ID Act basically came in through the back door, got passed in the House. There were no dissenting votes in the Senate. And it got signed into law. By the time people read it, they thought the biggest problem with it was the federal government getting involved in the issuance of a state driver's license. I reached out to a state lawmaker who started an organization called Legislators Against Real ID, Larry, L-A-R-I. So I reached out to this legislator, Jim Guest in Missouri. And I said, look, you haven't even tipped the surface of the real problem with the Real ID Act. And so I went to the Capitol of Missouri a number of times. I sat down with them and I explained to them, under the Real ID Act, it could be used to, if you purchase a weapon or ammunition, require a Real ID compliant license, creating a de facto firearm registry. So by the time I got done speaking to him about the official purposes, the fact that it was digital with international standards, which could lead a lot of Christians to understand the potential Mark of the Beast ramifications, Jim started traveling around the country, but he kept telling people it was about creating a national ID. And I kept telling him, no. It's part of a global system of identification and financial control. Well, he felt the American public really wasn't capable of understanding that it was part of a global system of identification. So people in the media, advocacy groups stuck with the idea it was just about creating a national ID. I realized that wasn't good enough. So I started going from state to state around the country, meeting with state legislators, testifying before committees, whether it was in Oklahoma, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, all over the country, Michigan. I testified. And in every state that I testified, they either passed a law or some kind of a resolution stating they would not comply with the Real ID Act. They would prohibit the people that issue driver's licenses in their state from participating in Real ID.
Okay, did they
and
get
the
it?
Number got up to 26 states.
Okay, so did the reason or the justification behind this resistance of the states, did it migrate, change, or was it all the same sentiment? And what was the real reason why they were pushing back saying, you can't do this?
The real reason was people only saw one layer deep of the onion, because that's all lawmakers want to take time to understand. And that one layer being the federal government getting involved in state driver's licenses, which led me to start the Stop Real ID Coalition with another person. We're both co-founders in the Stop Real ID Coalition. I felt the American people need to understand this was much more than just being about the federal government getting involved in the issuance of a state driver's license. So we started the Stop Real ID Coalition, really, back in 2006, but didn't become vocal till 2007, when I heard from the federal government the investigation against the largest biometric company in the United States had been dropped. So that's when I really started hitting the road for months at a time. I would stay in some states for entire legislative sessions just to make sure that state would oppose the Real ID Act. And as I said, 26 states eventually opposed it by law or by resolution. And that was as of about 2010. But, and this is the big but, in most states, the governor, leadership in the legislature, and law enforcement really have control over what media in that state or commonwealth tells the public. So the story the media was telling the public is, if our state or commonwealth does not become Real ID compliant, you're not going to be able to board a commercial airliner. And if you're a grandmother, you're not going to be able to go see your grandchildren.
Right.
Or they won't be able to fly and see you unless you have compliant Real ID driver's license.
Okay, so let me pause right there. So you made a comment that I want to be clear, which legislative body controls the messaging of media?
Legislative leadership.
Is your state Senate, state or Congress?
State.
Okay.
State. So controls the media in their own state.
Okay, so this is interesting, because one would think it out of these 26 states to say there's a reason why we're not doing this, and that the media would actually not be going out and saying you can't go visit, you know, Billy Bob and Mary Jane, your grandchildren. You know, the federal government is trying to usurp. You think that they would be telling that narrative, but by the way they were using this, you know, this heart appeal that grandparents couldn't see their grandchildren unless they drove, or, you know, because they can't fly. Again, I don't see how a red state legislative body would, if they were controlling the media, how they would allow that to happen. Does that make sense?
What happened is, when members of state legislatures start getting calls from constituents, and they were getting calls from grandmothers and other people who wanted to be able to fly commercially on a domestic airliner, about the need for that state to be Real ID compliant, the media would reach out to law enforcement, the governor, and they'd say, look, you know, this Real ID thing, you may not like it, okay, but tell us why it's so important. So the 95% of a story that a state newspaper might publish would be about why it's important that we become Real ID compliant. If you're against Real ID, you're supporting terrorists.
Okay.
Because Real ID is meant to stop terrorists from entering our country.
Okay, right. And so that makes sense. And I wouldn't think that the state legislatures, that's their intent of, you know, trying to stop terrorists or doing those types of things. I think they were trying to do the right thing by holding the line, saying, federal government, you don't have the authority. But here's a question that's kind of popped into my mind. Okay, so now all of a sudden you've gone from buying stock into, you know, this technology and promoting it, to now becoming the guy trying to stop it.
Absolutely.
And so there was this, I mean.
I talked to people in the media, and I'd say, if you had a 500-line story, you know, 475 lines would be about why the state should be real ID compliant, talking about grandmothers not being able to see their grandchildren.
Right.
You might give 20, 25 lines to why real ID was a bad law.
Uh-huh.
If you continue to do that, that's not a fair and balanced way to report to your readers what's going on, and they're never going to understand why real ID is such an egregious law. Well, the federal government started handing out grant money after the real ID was signed into law. Some states wanted that grant money. They wanted to be able to improve the integrity of their driver's licenses so they couldn't be so easily counterfeited. And Real ID Act did help with that. Okay, so Real ID did help to slow down the proliferation of counterfeit driver's licenses. Okay, there were some good aspects to Real ID, but the problem was we didn't need the Real ID Act to address the good aspects. That could be done between states through what's called the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. All states belong to AMVA, American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. They could have all agreed to increase the integrity, better the integrity of state driver's licenses and make sure that people don't have more than one active license at a time. But instead of doing it through AMBA, the federal government wanted their footprint. They wanted control of a state driver's license.
So
the federal government went through Congress rather than through AMBA.
Right. So here's an interesting point, because as I read the Constitution to my law audience, one of the things I read in Article 1 is actually Section 10. And so Section 10 prohibits states from being able to enter into compacts, right? And so these states, you know, the fact is that I'm just pointing out that we've gotten to a point where the federal government says we have to be everything, but you've never delegated us to do everything. And they allow the states to do these things that they shouldn't do either. Does that make sense?
Yes, and
okay. Go ahead.
It's even worse than that.
Okay.
Because AMVA, its compact involves states sharing information with all the provinces of Canada. And then AMVA took it one step further and created what's called the Driver's License Agreement, which included all the districts of Mexico. So now we had an apparatus put in place that allowed for the information in a state DMV database to be shared with people in Canada, law enforcement in Canada,
right,
and with individuals in Mexico, law enforcement.
Right, and that all came from NAFTA basically back in 1993, because it was the year after Clinton was elected, the first year of the NAFTA got passed under his administration. So NAFTA drove those types of requirements for compliance to that unconstitutional trade treaty. But anyway, okay, it doesn't mean that all of these things are constitutional. And my listeners are very, I want to give them credit that they're fine-tuned to all of this.
Here's the key.
Go ahead.
Here's the key. The Real ID Act, according to the author, who was Congressman Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, a Republican, and by the way, I tend to lean center-right. I'm not a leftist or anything like that. Sensenbrenner is the same author of the USA Patriot Act. So the same guy who authored the Patriot Act authored the Real ID Act. But my point is, he wrote for the Heritage Foundation that the Real ID Act was voluntary. States didn't have to comply. You didn't have to have a Real ID compliant license to be able to fly domestically. You could purchase or acquire a U.S. passport
right.
and be allowed to fly using a U.S. passport. Well, it's much harder to get a passport than a driver's license.
Sure.
And it's also much more expensive.
Yep.
So the other part about this voluntary thing, as you know, as a person who studied the Constitution, there's a part of the Constitution that says the federal government can't coerce the states into accepting federal government mandates, laws, or other matters, what we call the coercion clause. So that's really what happened with Real ID. In 2010, when so many states opposed Real ID, they started hearing from their constituents. Advocacy groups, unfortunately, started saying Real ID is dead, Real ID is on life support, etc., etc. Well, I kept saying, no, it's not dead, it's not on life support. But unfortunately, once the advocacy groups took their eyes off the ball, legislators started to turn, and they said, okay, we'll go along with Real ID, we'll take the grant money that's being offered, and in 2021, by 2021, all states have been certified by the Department of Homeland Security to be Real ID compliant. And I will guarantee you to this day, you're not going to find 1% of state legislators or members of Congress that have read the Real ID Act, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, the final rules, and the Privacy Impact Assessment for the Real ID Act. They were voting basically on what Sensenbrenner told them, which is this will be a good tool to fight the war on terrorism.
Right.
And nobody wanted to be seen as soft on fighting the war on terrorism.
Right, right. So, okay, so there was this sentiment. The states pushed back, and interestingly enough, we had easily half of the states that were willing to take a stand against it. How many states actually implemented the Real ID Act at the very beginning?
Yeah, 4 or 5 immediately.
Okay, but I mean, so let's say going into 2012, because getting more states, as I understand it, there was like this real, there were a surge, it kind of trickled off, and then it really seemed like there wasn't any more states that were going to, actually adopt it. There were certain states that were actually pushing back against it, saying you couldn't do this. It's kind of like in that family. You got the real vocal sides, and then you have the fence setters. And the fence setters are just kind of sitting there going, well, who's going to win, or where's this going to go? And my point is that we had a majority of vocal opponents, and I think that there were fence setters that would have joined them had they've taken probably a real dominating high ground that would win, kind of like these lawsuits against Obamacare. But nobody went into the courts to basically say the federal government can't do this.
Okay. You raise a very good point. But the answer to your question really is this. Within the Real ID Act, there were what we call enforcement dates. In other words, when would you have to be Real ID compliant?
Right.
Otherwise, people in the state wouldn't be able to fly without a Real ID compliant license.
Right.
Or an acceptable federal ID document, like a passport.
The flying was like 2018.
2011 was one of those such dates.
Okay.
So in 2010, yes, you had 26 states through law resolution that opposed it. But as the enforcement date came upon quicker, more and more people in states, grandmothers and others, spoke up. And that 26 turned into 23, 20, 15. And that's really what happened in 2011 with the enforcement date. And by the way, that enforcement date has now been extended
yep.
all the way out to 2023.
Right, right. Yeah, so in the state, I moved up to Washington State, and they were non-compliant. And yes. And they, you know, when I got here, they wanted to know if I wanted to have one of those special IDs with my driver's license so that I could, you know, travel without a passport into Canada and so forth. And they basically told me that if I wanted to fly, I would need to get a passport after, I think it was 2018. But anyway, okay, so
you just raised an important point.
Go ahead.
And let's cover that for 1 minute.
Sure.
What you're talking about is a special driver's license. It's mm-hmm. called not real ID compliant. It is real ID compliant, but it's more.
It's a NAFTA compliant, right?
You're talking about enhanced driver's right. license.
Yes, correct.
EDL. Now, the difference between a real ID compliant license and enhanced driver's license, an enhanced driver's license has an RFID chip incorporated into it.
Ah.
And that was done under a separate law than real ID. That was done under what's called the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative. It allowed for these enhanced driver's licenses to be used in lieu of passports mm-hmm. to be able to travel to places like Canada, Mexico, other countries within the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. But too many people today think real ID compliant licenses have an RFID chip in them. No.
No, yeah. I get
enhanced
it.
Enhanced driver's sure. licenses do, but not the basic real ID
right,
license
right.
itself.
So nevertheless, I didn't get one, folks. but nevertheless, I became a lot more aware of some of the nuances of this. But okay, so now we're at this point where how many states are compliant with the Real ID Act today, 2022?
Today?
Yes.
50.
So in other words, all of the states have basically, one way or another, come on board, either dragging their feet or for whatever reason. And bottom line is that they didn't have one. Well, okay, so the Constitution didn't have the standing, and basically the state legislators, this is just one of many ways that the state legislators are failing to do their job in protecting the citizens of their state. So, okay, now that we've got all 50 on board, and so folks, just I've mentioned this before. Mark is one of the people that, you know, he's the key person that really helped us with the legislation we did in Wyoming, which was HB 0132 this past year. And it was a lot of this is my first rodeo in actually doing this. We tried to do this 2 years ago, last year, and we didn't get nearly as close. And we at least crossed the finish line and actually got the bill in. We didn't get the vote. So there's still some lessons, and we can talk about that later. The fact of the matter is, go ahead, yes.
GR, there's another aspect to all this.
Sure.
In order for a state to be considered real ID compliant, there were 39 benchmarks that were developed by Department of Homeland Security, working in coordination with Department of Transportation. 39 benchmarks that states had to comply with, or DHS felt they were making a good faith effort to comply with them in order to be real ID compliant. And the governor or the attorney general or both had to submit a package to DHS saying we want to be real ID compliant, and DHS certified them, and thus that's how we have all 50 states being compliant by meeting these benchmarks. But one of the benchmarks, which is why I think President Trump and I don't want to get off on a wild tangent here, but this is as important as anything I'm ever going to say about Real ID. One of the benchmarks of the Real ID Act required that when you take your birth certificate into your DMV, that birth certificate be verified as being your birth certificate issued by the state where you were born. And we have a way to do that. And I'm not going to get into the mechanics of that. It'd take a whole nother show. But the point is, you think when you take your birth certificate into DMV, You are who you say you are. You know that. You think when you're getting DMV or birth certificate, they now know you are who you say they are. They must be verifying your birth certificate in some way. Or people could be using counterfeit birth certificates or the birth certificates of deceased people. Well, guess what? Even though every state has been deemed real IT compliant, no state is verifying the birth certificates of people who are applying for driver's licenses. Not all the people. So, you can have people with driver's licenses, authentic driver's licenses, who use counterfeit birth certificates mm-hmm. or the birth certificates of deceased people to acquire authentic birth certificates or real ID compliant licenses, which can be used to register to vote, etc. So when President Trump said millions of people voted illegally, they or people who were in the country voted illegally,
mm-hmm.
people that were in the country illegally voted illegally, to be more precise.
Right.
He didn't know how accurate of a statement that could be.
Right.
Because nobody told him, the Constitutional Alliance did, nobody else would tell him that we're not verifying birth certificates as required under federal law. It's Public Law 109-13, Section 202-203, requires the birth certificates to be verified before the driver's license is issued. We are not doing that universally in the United States.
Yeah, so this begs a conversation, and as I kind of got a glance over, because time really flies by when we're talking, and so you know, we still have some time. So this begs the question as to when the Constitution was written, and very few people know this, my audience does, but when the Constitution was written, the control over the migration of people was basically managed by the states. The federal government did not have any controls over the migrations of people. Their initial role in immigration was to ensure that a uniform standard was being applied across the states. And so they were supposed to, you know, basically make sure that there was this uniform standard. However, in 1808, that all changed. The states then lost their sovereignty, their power over the migration of all people, and that responsibility shifted to the federal government. So here's the question. Nowhere in there does it talk about the necessity of being able to control U.S. citizens, ID, identify them. Bottom line, if you are a citizen of a state, you are, and this is in the language of the U.S. Constitution, you become a U.S. citizen because the federal government asserts jurisdiction over all citizens of all the states if you travel abroad and commit if you're accused of committing a crime on the high seas or committing a crime against the laws of nations. They demand jurisdiction over that. And that's to protect us from the harassments and the evil doings and nefarious activities of these other bad states. But, and the reason I'm pointing this out, because there's the sovereign citizen movement that thinks that, you know, the U.S. government doesn't have this ability of jurisdiction, but actually they did. And that was clear in the Constitution. But the point is, here's the question. If the federal government can regulate the travel of people leaving the states and coming back for passport purposes, you know, bottom line, to verify that you're the person that left and so forth and so on, then, you know, I think the states have really failed in coming together and trying to define how, when this role in 1808 shifted, what were they going to how were they going to define what the federal government could do? They really failed to do that, and in so doing, they kind of unconstitutionally assumed for themselves the federal government, because they can't assume anything. They basically have to start, you know, going to the states. We believe that this is implied. This is very specific within this power. If it's not, then they can't do it. And so when they started reaching and going down this path, this created a problem that we've all inherited that started back in the early 1800s. Does that make sense?
It does, but this is why when Sensenbrenner authored the bill, he made it voluntary. And this is why people need to understand. It was made voluntary because the federal government really has no constitutional basis for the Real ID Act, but through coercion, they got the states to comply to become Real ID certified.
Yeah, so when you say voluntary, you're not talking about individual voluntary, state voluntary.
It was both individual and state voluntary, because within the Real ID Act, it said states had the authority to issue non-Real ID compliant driver's licenses.
Right.
The difference being, on the front of a non-Real ID compliant license, it must be stated not for federal official purposes or federal purposes. So they distinguish between a Real ID compliant license, which has a gold star on the front of it, and one that's not Real ID compliant that has wording not for federal purposes. But right. To show you how bad this is, GR, I went to both, well, as I was going around the country testifying, I had the chance to ask questions of Darrell Williams, who was Department of Homeland Security Director for Implementation of Real ID. And I asked him, what's the relationship between the federal government and Amblin? Because I thought, and I still do, and I believe, Amblin could have done the same things without Real ID Act. Okay, through their best practices.
Okay.
He said there were no, was no relationship. Well, I knew at that point the public, everybody was being duped. There was a relationship between the federal government and AMBA because the federal government through the Department of Transportation had been issuing grant money to states to join AMBA's, what we call driver's license agreement, that allow for information to be shared with authorities in Canada and in Mexico.
Right.
So my point is, I went to both the American Center on Law and Justice, Virginia Beach, Virginia, Jay Sokolow's group. Lawmakers wrote a letter of introduction for me. The ACLJ agreed to meet with me. I met with their head leader or chief litigator, Skip Ash. Then I went to Washington. I met with the ACLU's national point person, Larry Frankel on Real ID. And I got them both to agree to come to the National Press Club with the Constitutional Alliance and speak out against the Real ID Act. It's the only time that anybody can remember the ACLU National and the ACLJ, American Center on Law and Justice, coming together on the same stage to oppose a single piece of legislation enacted into law, the Real ID Act.
Right.
So that video is available on the Constitutional Alliance website, constitutionalalliance.org. One word, you just put in Constitutional Alliance, then .org. Go to the videos, download it, download, you know, the drop thing, and you'll see Constitutional Alliance National Press Club and see the ACLJ sitting on the right of me and the ACLU sitting on the left of me. But that's how universal it was understood. This was in about 2008, 2009, the opposition to the Real ID Act was.
Okay, so folks, all of the Constitutional Alliance Mark info, what he just gave you, that, as always, is right there on our other links. So, you know, when you want to look this stuff up, you want to look at the video, because if you're driving, it's hard to write and drive. Just go to our other links on the Reclaiming the Republic website. So let me get to this, because we're really running out of time. And this may require a third segment. And I don't know if you have time today, if we have to do this later. It's time to actually talk about that second, the real reason behind all of this. Kind of like what's going on in Ukraine, and everybody's all concerned about you know, Russia using nuclear weapons and that type of stuff and trying to take seize control of the Ukraine. The real prize in the world for Russia is to create, it's the Gog and Magog. This is my paradigm. I see Gog and Magog have to create this alliance so that they can wipe out Israel off of the map. And so nobody's saying, nobody's walking around with this little, you know, the things to do list and wipe off Israel off the top, it was right there on the top of the list is, you know, getting rid of them. My point is that the real reason behind all of this, this intricate web work, because you talk about how all of these connections are being done. And when you look at a spider web, there's typically just one spider. What we have, folks, is a fabric. It's layers of spiders that are stitching together their own webs with other webs. They're all so interconnected that they're creating this what one would perceive as an inescapable trap, that we're all trapped within this web work. But because I just want you to understand, this is how maniacal and how deep the planning and the involvement in all of these things go. Bottom line, and this is where when Mark and I started talking, it really came right out to 666, the mark of the beast. And so when we look at, you know, the Real ID Act and this concept of no longer really even having to show an ID, because they're going to be able to, they'll know who you are. They will speak to you with either artificial intelligence or via an intercom system to the camera. You're looking at the camera and they're talking to you, right?
Absolutely. Now your words are music to my ears. One of the things I've done, gone across the country, I've spoken at dozens of churches. I've appeared on the three largest Christian television networks.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we refer to this as the precursor to the mark of the beast,
mm-hmm.
Revelation 13, 15 through 18, also in Leviticus, but that's another story. Here's the situation. If you look at the word bio, it means body. Metric means measurements or numbers. Literally, your biometrics are the number of man, the distances between mm-hmm. key characteristics of your face, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes much further, because this is using international standards. There are already networks in place, international global sharing networks, whatever you want to call them. Interpol has one, ENLITS has one, but they allow for biometrics to be shared between countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is, in our country today, if you think about it, you're required to provide your biometrics, usually your fingerprints, when you open up a bank account. With facial recognition under Real ID to be able to fly on a domestic airliner,
mm-hmm.
you're requiring a person's biometrics to fly. Now, to be able to buy and sell, there was a bill in Congress a few years ago, it keeps getting reintroduced, called the Photo Identification Security Act. This bill would require all banks to make sure you have a Real ID compliant license before they do business with you. Then there was a bill called the Legal Workforce Act. It requires all employers, regardless of their size, 2 people, 55,000, to require a biometric facial image, digital high-resolution digital facial image, before you can go to work. And that facial image has to be made available to the Department of Homeland Security. Now, these bills are going to be reintroduced now that all states are considered Real ID compliant.
Mm-hmm.
This is a recent development, literally less than a year ago. So when these bills get introduced, you are literally being enrolled into a single global system of identification that controls your ability to buy, sell, travel, and work if that's not the precursor to the mark of the beast, I don't know what is.
Right. So one of the things that I think is going to be, I think everybody's going to have to, this is a challenge for everyone. We're going to be confronted, because I truly believe that it's one thing for you to live an innocent life and be drafted. In other words, you can't be compelled to, you know, sell your soul. I truly believe that they're going to come to a point where they're going to get you. They're going to make an appeal to all living people on this planet, and they're going to give you an offer you won't refuse. And I don't want to get into that in this show today. We don't have the time. But
can I interrupt for 1 second here, GR?
Sure.
This, if you're a Christian, you need to understand what I'm about to say. 90% plus of the world's population is already enrolled into this global system. Now, you might say, wait a minute. How would people in a remote village in India, where there's no electricity, no running water, how could they possibly already be enrolled in this system? Well, believe me or not, they take donkeys, they put laptops, computers with satellite capability, you know, all the equipment needed to go into all these villages and enroll each person in that village. In India, their global system of identification is called Aadhaar. A-A-D-H-A-A-R. Over 95% of India's population is already in this system. China's in it, Russia, the countries of South America. On the continent of Africa, you've got 55, 57 countries. They're all in it. Over 95% of all U.S. citizens are in it.
Okay.
There are only two states now that allow for a valid without photo driver's license. So just about every American driver, adult, is in the system.
Okay, so I have to apologize, because I'm going to run out of time, because I do have to do the bookends to the show, and we kind of covered the full segment here. Mark, we're going to have you back. I don't know if you have the time now to do a final segment, but either way, folks, we're going to have Mark back again, because I believe now we're actually having the conversation that I honestly think most people really want to, you know, understand, because we haven't even talked about how you can get involved, how you can start doing these things in fighting and understanding what to do, how to get organized, so forth and so on. So I appreciate your patience. Do you have time to do another stayover so we can do
yes.
You know, for the next show? Okay, great. All right. Well, folks, we're going to go to a break. We're going to end today's show, and we will be right back tomorrow with the final segment with this great conversation with Mark Lerner from the Constitutional Alliance. So we'll be right back after this. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Oh.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so we're going to have Mark back tomorrow, and we're going to get into what I was kind of alluding to, a final conversation. What I'm really doing is putting an end to this conversation at this point, because there are a lot of things we could go into. There's a lot of details and stuff that I honestly think it's very good. As I mentioned before, and as I talk about this, there are things that we do throughout our day-to-day routine that are essential. You got to eat. You know, you should be reading scriptures. You should be praying. I could sit here and preach to you all the things that you should be doing, but that's not my job. I'm not called to do that as your minister or priest or what have you. My focus, and I believe the urgency that I feel of what I need to do, is to help you connect the dots to unify on the Constitution. If you want to call me a unifier, that's great. That's a fitting term. Mark is an educator on a very specific issue. This issue is so important because it talks about the end, some of the things that we as Christians should be understanding and completely place direct context to how this is going to affect us. So with that, we're going to talk more with Mark down the road. And my intent in future conversations, once we kind of create the final chapter of this one conversation, my intent to talk with Mark is what we have to do specifically in the process of getting organized and submitting bills. I learned a lot from Mark already, and he helped us in kind of prepping for this legislative session for Wyoming. I'll tell you, these types of things are so important that you can't marginalize these. But again, you can't also be consumed with the compliments and flattering people either. We got a lot of work to do, and we got to get our butts busy. The one thing I don't think I've connected the dots on this, but now you're starting to see the picture of the magnitude of how good this man is, how great this man is, as far as being an example of being a patriot. When we were attacked as a patriot, as somebody that was really not very involved, but he was a patriot, he actually, based on 9/11, turned his life around and dedicated his life in trying to make sure that we never got attacked again. And then, in the process, realized that what he thought was the solution was absolutely, a bigger problem. And and starting to kind of connect all of these other dots, he's at this point where he realizes that, we actually have to be doing things very specifically and strategically to win this battle. Stopping the Real ID Act and undoing this and getting your states on board is going to be critical. But we have to get organized. And so that's why next week on Monday, we're going to go right back into what we need to do, where we need to go, where we need to be. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.